show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Spring has sprung, if not in name only. The weather has not cooperated, but regardless, baseball is being played, albeit not as much as scheduled, quite literally, given that the Royals and many other teams across the league have had rainouts or snowouts, whatever the case may be. It's particularly this past Easter Sunday, we're recording on April 3rd for posterity, but the today's the 4th. Sorry,
April 4th.
And the Easter Sunday was just absolutely awful, just terrible weather. So they canceled the game, rescheduled the game, postponed it. So regardless, we'll get into all of that stuff in a few minutes here. But first, of course, I am Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, is the man who is never has bad weather. I'm struggling. I don't know. I had something, and then I lost it.
It ran away.
Well. You're Michael Engel tonight, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm ready for it to really be spring, and not this like pretend spring where it's 60 degrees one day of the week, and then
yeah, pretend spring is the worst.
Just kidding. 30 degrees. Ha! Take that. No, it's. It's crazy. Weird week where the Royals played four games. They basically played like a college team schedule.
Yeah.
Give or take. Just in a whole week, they played four games. And there was a question of if they'd get yesterday's game in, but the weather cooperated just enough. I was kind of rooting for that to get rained out just for the absurdity of 7 days and three games taking place. But
yeah.
Just didn't happen, which is good because the Royals actually got a win yesterday. So
yes,
I'm glad they got
that. Which is very important
now
because it means that today we can talk about a team that is not winless,
yeah.
And due to at least a part of a reason, we obviously don't know the results of the games that were canceled or postponed, but because of them, the Royals are not in last place.
Yeah, by half a game.
Yes, the Detroit Tigers are 1-4, and the Royals are 1-3. So where to start with all this business here? I think we'll just kind of give a recap of what we've seen so far, and the season has not been off to a good start. Obviously, they're 1-3, but beyond that, you know, sometimes the ball doesn't bounce your way. Every team, good or bad, is likely going to lose 3 out of 4 games at some point in a season. You never want to start off that way, of course. But regardless, you know, it's one thing to go 1-3 in a 4-game stretch, but it's another thing to go 1-3, score 12 runs in 4 games, and give up 24 runs in that same period. So.
Yeah.
This team that, you know, I mean, it's 4 games, so there's absolutely no conclusions that can be drawn from any of this. 4 games is, you know, infinitesimal in the context of a baseball season. So not that it's completely meaningless, but there's no meaningful conclusions you can draw from this at this point. But that said, you know, you can still talk about what has happened because we got nothing, you know, it's our only option.
Right.
But, I mean, so far this team, you know, that we thought would have a lot of power, and it could still be there, of course. And early season, it's always hard to tell because the weather and all that business. You know, so
right. When it's 12 degrees out.
Right. every excuse you've heard before about early season baseball still applies. Not to say that it does excuse the Royals for some of their poor play, but
right. The White Sox had no problem.
with finding some power.
So
they have hit more than one home run, which is the Royals' entire team total.
Yep.
They have hit more than that in one inning against the Royals.
Yeah.
So there is that. But Drew Butera did hit the one home run for the Royals on opening day in the first inning in what looked like the Royals might be cruising to an easy victory until Danny Duffy decided to – you know what? I want to make a disclaimer about this because we talked about this last week on the show. What does Danny Duffy have to do to make me not scared when he goes out on the mound? And I said, I don't think he's gonna blow up. I think he's going to be okay. But the possibility is always there. It's always in my mind because of his past history. But I still take no responsibility for the fact that he did not do anything in his first appearance this year to assuage those fears that he would no longer have any blow-ups, because he did, in fact, have such a blow up. Gave up three home runs in one inning. Yeah. He ended up giving five runs total before they pulled him. And or I guess five runs total on the line. I can't remember if all those were scored before he left the game, because it was a pretty crazy game. Lots of scores. It ended up being a 14-7 rout on opening day. Just bad. Yeah. Badness all the way around. I mean, I guess it's a positive that the Royals scored seven runs, but if you consider the fact that they've scored 12 runs total and seven on opening day, that means they've scored a total of five runs in the three games that have followed.
Yeah.
Which looks worse. Even their win, their one lone win, was a 1-0 scorcher. So, and there are some positives to talk about with that game, which we'll get to, but, you know, so far, it's simply not been that great.
Not yet.
And it's, you know, starting pitching hasn't been good. The bullpen has been really very poor and bad and should feel bad. not many other ways to go about it, to be honest. Now, you know, conversely, the one game they did win, the bullpen pitched very well. Kept them in the game, closed out the game. Very good performances there on that particular game. But, you know, the pitching has not been great. And then on top of that, the Royals have an offense that is mid-2000s anemic in its inability to score runs, as we mentioned. And, you know, it's early on in the season, especially after four games. You know, we talk about how there's no meaningful conclusions that can be drawn because there's so many wild shifts that can happen just from a good game. You get two hits in a row and your batting average jumps, you know, hundreds and hundreds of points just from a couple hits because there's so few sample size here. Oftentimes you see a lot of inflated batting averages early on because maybe somebody starts the season hot or whatever, but there's only one Royal hitting over, or two Royals hitting over 250 right now. One is John Jay and one is Chesler Cuthbert. So the rest of the roster, there is one at 250 to be fair. Moose is hitting 250. But 250 and below is the rest of the roster. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of clunkers in there. Whit Merrifield's hitting 188. Alex Gordon, 143, right on cue. You know, Lucas Duda's hitting 200. Butera's hitting 222. I mean, it's, you know, it's not – the prospects are not that great right now offensively. And, again, there's no – that's not to say Gordon's going to hit 143 the whole season, though he might.
Yeah.
But just like you wouldn't imagine Chesler Cuthbert would hit 400 for the first time in however many years.
Right, yeah.
This year, you know, you're not going to imagine that Whit Merrifield is going to go through the season hitting 188. You know, he's going to be better than that. But at the same time, you know, you can't look at it and say, man, the offense has been poor in these four games that we've seen. And it's been painful to watch, to listen to read about. There hasn't been a ton of good going on. When you look, you know, what you've seen from the games, what you see from the stat line, box scores, all that stuff. I mean, how do you feel about this first four games so far?
Well, first, I think you misspoke on the home run. It was Lucas Duda, and you said Drew Butera.
Did I say Butera? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all that. It's that ooh sound. Happening.
I guess so. Yeah.
They both have it doubling up. But I mean, yeah, like you said, it's very early. There's a lot of things that you just can't tell from the first four games of, you know, anybody's season. You know, you'll see it all the time where a player over four games, they might not hit that well. You know, Paulo Orlando's 1-for-12 in his first four games. It happens. You know, you'll see players do that all the time. It only stands out because it is early, because there's no other stats. If this happened in the middle of May, yeah, their averages would drop, but, you know, it wouldn't be that big of an effect just because they'd already have a little bit already built up. But I think there's also a little bit of, you know, first, yeah, you can qualify. It's early. It's cold. Hitting's usually a little more difficult in the cold sometimes. I think you can kind of get a feel for, like, you know, we're worried, would Alex Gordon struggle? And so far he has struggled. Jorge Soler, there's a lot of talk about new approach. He's 0-for-8 so far. Does that matter? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, in a couple of cases, guys are hitting the ball hard. I think Soler had a ball that was like a 98% hit probability, or maybe it was only like 80% or something. But, like, you know, it was 110-mile-per-hour exit velocity, and it was caught. And it was caught in a deep part of center field in Detroit. So, you know, it's you kind of have to worry more about the process of things than the results to some degree. You know, if guys were hitting the ball, you know, hardly hard at all, and they were had this kind of number, you know, that kind of batting average, then yeah, maybe you worry a little bit more to start out. But guys like Moustakas, Soler, they're hitting the ball hard. You know, so I'm not super worried. It's four games. It could happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think when you look at, like, the pitching side, we knew the bullpen was going to be iffy. We've already seen Brandon Maurer blow a lead. Duffy was pretty good his first three innings on opening day, and then that fourth inning he got hammered, and just, you know, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you leave the ball over the middle and it gets hit, and that's what happened. Jason Hamill had, you know, some bright spots last year, but that third time through the order was a problem for him repeatedly, and again, that's what happened in the third game of the season to him. So that's troubling. But, you know, there's also encouraging signs. You know, Ian Kennedy had a pretty good start. It just got squandered by the blown save by Maurer. Kelvin Herrera has come out, and in three games, he struck out five guys with no walks, and he looks a lot better than he did last year.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jake Junis had a fantastic start.
Jake Junis is like, everybody's like, I mean, the thing is, we know that the Royals struggle to develop their own pitching, and they've generally been okay at finding guys out of their minor league system who can be relievers and capable relievers and even very good relievers, but finding those starters has been difficult. It's basically been Duffy, who, you know, we've had our, you know, questions about him, even though, you know, he broke out in 2016 and he was fine last year, and I think he'll be fine and pretty good this year. And Yordano Ventura, who, you know, obviously, tragically, he's no longer with us. And that's kind of it. Unless you count Sean Manaea, who is, you know, pitched pretty well for Oakland, and some other guys who've been traded. But, you know, for what the Royals have, they haven't developed a lot of guys. So Jake Junis is kind of that next hope, as someone who doesn't throw super hard, but he's got good control, good command, and that slider just seems to get better the more he's in the league.
Mm-hmm.
Froze Miguel Cabrera with a really good one, so that's fun. So you hope you see more of that from him. So, you know, they're basically one time through their rotation, and, you know, there's been some good and there's been some bad. It's, you know, it's I don't know that there's a lot of conclusions to be drawn yet. But, you know, some guys who have kind of started out pretty well, like Moustakas, John Jay, Cuthbert, those guys, you figure they're going to be big parts of the lineup, and they're starting strong, so that's good. Duda with a home run, that's encouraging. And, you know, when you consider that some of these guys can take walks, like Soler and Jay and Duda, that'll help their value a little bit as the batting average kind of catches up. So, you know, I think the offense, they're probably still not going to be good. But I think they're going to be better than, you know, five runs the last three games that we've seen. So I think that's, you know, there's probably going to be some positive regression on that side. So I don't know. I don't expect a whole lot this year. I mean, we both have them at 72 wins. So, I mean, I guess the main thing is you look for encouraging signs from some of the players that can either be traded later this summer or guys who you figure will be around the next few years. So like Merrifield, I think he's going to be fine when it comes down to it. You know, I mean, he's hitting 188, but I'm not worried about him. Cuthbert is starting out pretty well. Soler, maybe he'll be fine. I don't know. So, you know, it's there's a lot of season left, so I'm not going crazy about too much. I've also said this, I think, a couple times over the years, is that, like, the first week or two of baseball is always weird because we're coming off of, you know, winter where you see the NFL and then you see the NFL playoffs and the Super Bowl, and then that goes right into, like, college basketball and conference play and conference tournaments and March Madness. And like so many of those games in those other sports, one game is such a swing. Mm-hmm. And then you jump into baseball where a 1-3 stretch is nothing. You know, you can go 1-3 in a playoff series and still win the playoff series.
That's a good point.
So, I mean, it's like, it's not really that big of a deal. In the grand scheme of things. And so I think people overreact a lot to early season results in baseball. Ron Chandler he's mostly done like fantasy writing the last few years or so, but I forget the name of the player that he named the principal, but it's like, it's basically that a player who plays well early and is bad in the second half ends up, you know, getting overinflated because that early stretch is what, you know, kind of colors your perception of him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like that for early season baseball, in that if the Royals are terrible in April, that's all people are going to remember because that was their first impression of the team. And even if they're okay in July, August, and September, people are just going to remember, yeah, but they were real bad in April. So I don't know. I mean, I'm interested in just seeing kind of how things go, how the lineup comes together, and just kind of what develops from there. So I'm not too concerned about anything at this point. Nothing's troubling to me.
Yeah, I think,
except Brandon Maurer. Let's be fair on that.
Yeah. I like to look at kind of the first 40 games for that. I've always kind of thought that, you know, those first 40 games really define your season in terms of perception. You know, obviously 40 games, even that, which is a lot more, we've talked a lot about that 40 game mark being where you can finally start to glean some sort of idea of what the person is going to do during the season. But you've still got, you know, 3/4 of the season left after that, that can make a huge difference to your, your season actually turns out. But after those first 40 games, you know, by then you're halfway to the All-Star break, basically. People are, you know, the newness of baseball has worn off at that point, so people may not be following it as close, and it's summer's in full swing, so people have more stuff to do, and so those whatever happened those first 40 games often kind of colors the perception, definitely. So I would certainly agree with that point. And I think what's, I don't know if disconcerting is the right word, because it's too early for something like that at this point in the season, but you know, like you talked about, you and I are both have been lukewarm at best, I would say, on the Royals,
yeah.
And especially in terms of, you know, offensive prospects. But so given that, and there are a lot of people that are, you know, either feel the same or worse about the Royals than we do. And so when you have that kind of collective idea of, oh, man, this could be bad, you know, it also could be better than we thought, but it could be bad. And then you see the first four games and so many of the fears that people were talking about, well, what if Soler doesn't hit? What if Gordon is back to, you know, the poor seasons he's had the last couple of years, et cetera, et cetera. If those things turn out to be true, it's going to be a long, long season for the Royals. And again, nothing to be, you know, nothing concrete. It's only been four games, absolutely nothing. it's not nothing, but it's next to nothing in baseball terms. So, you know, again, not drawing any conclusions, but when you have that increase of impact because it's the first start of the season, along with people kind of, you know, that like not really sure what to think and hoping for the best, and even though you might be preparing for the worst, and then, you know, so far for four games, the worst basically happened. So, yeah. You know, it's kind of that confirmation bias type of thing. Like, well, I thought the Royals were going to suck. These first four games have been terrible. Their offense has looked awful. The bullpen has looked bad. Starting pitching hasn't been great. Everything I thought would suck has sucked so far, even though it's only been four games. So, you know, if you're somebody, if you're a fan who thinks like that, it's not encouraging to see what you've seen. And so that's, you know, that's the most unfortunate aspect about it, because you're absolutely right, you know, that anything, if you, you know, if it was a one and three stretch in August where Alex Gordon hit 143 for four games, you know, depending on what he did the rest of the season, you know, you'd just be like, bad stretch, yeah. Bad week. Maybe he was having trouble sleeping. He had a cold, or, you know, summer cold, whatever. And these things happen. But unfortunately, it's the early season, and the only thing we have to look at is that number of 143 next to batting average for Alex Gordon, so it looks really bad. And when you were already thinking that it might be really bad for Alex Gordon, it's not encouraging when you see your fears become realized. So, you know, that is a very unfortunate aspect, even beyond just the results themselves. So,
and just to illustrate how some of those early struggles can, well, and in this case, how they can kind of be wiped away, you know, how many people remember that Eric Hosmer last year hit 5.7 or had a 573 OPS at the end of April?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he finished the year great. Now, granted, he basically had to have over a 900 OPS the rest of the way to finish where he did, but, you know, it shows that over the longer term, if you play well for two out of every 3 months, you're probably going to have an okay season. If you have a really good 5 months after that first bad month, you're going to have a really good season. And so if the Royals have, you know, some bad results early, they've still got a lot of time to turn things around. Granted, you still want to see them do well right out of the gate, but you know, they could be bad and still turn things around. They could be bad and stay bad. We just don't know. We have guesses. We have some historical idea of if they're going to be good or bad. But, you know, we just don't know. And, you know, really this year is kind of a fact-finding year anyway. So, I don't know. It's the first couple weeks are always, yeah, they're always a little crazy. That being said, if in 2 weeks Alex Gordon's still hitting 143, well, then I think that goes back to the confirmation that you mentioned. It's like we're worried about Alex Gordon, thus.
Yes.
If he's doing worrisome things, well, that's not going to help anybody. So, I don't want to like pump sunshine and be like, well, they could turn it around. No, I mean, they might still be bad. But I think the guys who are really bad won't be this bad. For one, Paulo Orlando is still this bad in 3 weeks. Well, he's going to be in Omaha, and we're going to see whoever else could play center field as a fourth outfielder in his place, because, you know, there's no reason to see what Paulo Orlando can do with a bunch of at-bats when he's, you know, getting a hit every 12 at-bats. You know, he's 32. There's nothing developmental there. It's just he's just who he is. So if he's still doing poorly, they're going to get away from that pretty quickly. If Alex Gordon is, then they have some tough questions. But, the bad performers usually find their way to not be performing, I guess, is a way to put it.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see month to month and everything, how things go. Things tend to even out. So.
Indeed. But the, it hasn't been super encouraging. But again, lots of time to make that up. And the one thing that has been encouraging, you know, we kind of touched on it, the Jake Junis and his very good start. He, in the Royals' victory, he pitched 7 innings, only gave up 3 hits, had 6 strikeouts, and only 1 walk. So by far the best performance of any Royals pitcher so far. Ian Kennedy had a solid start. He had a 6 innings, 4 hits, gave up 1 run, 2 walks, 5 strikeouts. A very Ian Kennedy-like performance from that one. Maybe a little bit better than he's used to with only the 1 run, but everything else seemed about right. But then, of course, you know, as you mentioned, Jason Hamill got bit by that third time through the order bug, and Danny Duffy, unfortunately, had the blow up that we've already discussed. So, pitching is going through a similar woes as the hitting is for the team. You know, the bullpen, you talked about
some ugly Brandon numbers. Maurer.
Yes, Brandon Maurer is currently sitting with a 16.2 ERA from 1.2 innings pitched. Blaine Boyer, who the Royals simply had to have this offseason,
just don't get it.
He is sitting at 18 ERA after 2 innings pitched. Brian Flynn has a 20.25 ERA after 1.1 innings pitched. Those are just the highlights.
Oh, then there's Birch Smith, who has an infinite ERA.
Oh, that's right. It does say that. I've never seen that. I was actually wondering what that was, but that's what happens when you don't
get
an out.
You don't get an out.
That is nuts.
If you never get out, you're going to give up. I mean, he's
going to give up runs forever.
He's got that one appearance. So, I mean, he hasn't had opportunity to get
that's
that.
Literally
out
0 innings. But
yep. Yeah.
That's.
Yeah. I also, another thing I noticed is there are a lot of guys with names starting with B in the Royals bullpen. Doesn't mean anything. It's just something I observed.
Brad, Blaine, Brandon, Brian, Birch. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Sounds like a
very good point.
I don't know what that sounds like. Car dealership or something.
Sounds like a waspy family.
Yeah. The only real, I mean.
That, can I say that? Should I have said that? I probably shouldn't have said
no,
that.
No, it's fine. Cool. Who cares? I mean, Herrera starting out, that's encouraging. Brad Keller, one of the, you know, both Rule 5 guys made the roster at opening day. So that was kind of cool. There was kind of a question of Birch Smith towards the end there. But Brad Keller's come out. He's looked all right. Justin Grimm, I think he gave up that run on opening day, but, you know, otherwise he's come out and pitched pretty well. So maybe there's a semblance of something with some of those guys. And in particular, guys like Grimm, like Keller, like, you know, Smith, if he can stick around. They're guys who will probably be around a lot more. Whereas, you know, you look at on the offensive side, guys like Duda, like John Jay, even Moustakas and Escobar probably won't be here, you know, in August. You're probably not going to be worried about most of those guys. But some of these guys that are on, you know, in the on the pitching staff right now will be somewhere in the system or you know, potentially somewhere in the system. So, I mean, that's something to kind of keep an eye on. And if you see someone like Brad Keller come out, who I think has never pitched above double A, that's encouraging, you know, to see him come out and just jump right in. So if he can do that, you know, you might have something. Jake Junis, obviously, he's pitching well. That's definitely great. What were you saying?
Well, I was just going to say I have before we move off too much, I have a hard time trusting Justin Grimm through absolutely no fault of his own, only because his name reminds me of Jason Grimsley. I think you knew where I was going with that.
Oh, yeah.
And I certainly didn't trust Jason Grimsley, not with the baseball or with my dog or anything. Not that he has any specific history with dogs, but just that he, you know, with all his issues that he had.
Ken Harvey doesn't trust him either, so.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Know, no big deal. So,
yeah, Justin Grimm, that's kind of like, I think the White Sox have a guy named Aaron Bummer.
Oh,
I don't know what his first name is, but his last name is Bummer. Grant Balfour was a pitcher. Homer
William
Bailey.
The guy in the Royals, Scott Blewett.
Scott Blewett, yeah. Yeah, it's like, man, how do the pitchers get all these names? It's like,
I know, right?
Joe Strikesout is the Royals
right?
left fielder.
The Balfour is the most fantastic one.
Yeah.
Especially because he's actually been pretty good.
Yeah, he's pretty good reliever.
His career, you know. But that's just, it's too perfect. You know, I don't even know what the equivalent
Balfour, yeah.
be. Like, hey, my name is Scott Throws a Touchdown. I'm your quarterback. Like, it's just, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Like,
but anyway, sorry, I didn't want to get too far off Justin Grimm to drop the Jason Grimsley bomb, but continue with your thought. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, I was just kind of looking at all the names. Tim Hill made his major league debut. He looked so-so. So, I mean, there's stuff. There's guys, and those ERAs will fall, even Brandon Mowers.
There are guys.
Those are guys. Blaine Breuer's, his ERA will probably fall. I still don't get it, but.
And you know what? Speaking of don't get, let's talk about. That's a good transition.
Yeah, let's talk about the other weird results.
Yeah, the other weird stuff that's going on. The Royals haven't really stood pat in terms of the roster. You know, it seems like, I suppose it's a good thing that you know, they continue to look and they're trying to massage the roster and get put themselves in the best position to win. I'm just curious what they think is the best position to win. And the reason I have to ask that question is because we just found out this week that the Royals decided to designate Miguel Almonte, a guy that we've talked about quite a bit on this show and over the years, and who's been with the organization a long time, had a pretty good spring, had a lot of people thinking that he could be a piece of the bullpen that would actually, you know, provide some value for the Royals. Not that he was, you know, the next Wade Davis, but that he certainly could be, you know, a decent piece of the bullpen. They let him go. And in a bizarre turn of events, they decided that the reason they had to let him go was because they simply could not let Abraham Almonte sit on the sidelines for any longer than he already had. So they picked him up. So, of course, the notification I got on my phone that night after everything went through was Royals DFA Almonte, Royals sign Almonte. So that was kind of a head scratcher until I figured out exactly what was going on. But
like, the king is dead. Long live the king.
Exactly. Like what? I mean, Abraham Almonte, you know, okay, I guess. Yeah, and I think Dave Leske said it back best when we were talking about it. You know, he's a guy that you pick up if you have 37 people on your 40-man roster. You know, he's not someone that you make a move to go get. And, I mean, I'm talking about a guy who – I just pulled up his stats here. I mean, he's 28.
He'll be 29 in June.
He's had 949 career plate appearances. He's had that's in
like over six or seven years or something. Yeah. I mean, he's
or no, 2013. So yeah, that's almost 6 years now.
He's been on like four other teams. He's a switch hitter. Doesn't, you know, hit for much average. Doesn't really get on base. Doesn't have a lot of power. I don't get. I mean, fine. You want to pick that guy up, see what he does. You know, depth is always good. It's fine, but it's like, why are you taking someone who could reasonably be in your top 10, 15 prospects, who pitched well this spring? Why is that the guy you're finding a way to, you know, to dump off your roster just to claim this guy? I don't. You know, every part of that move is just weird. Like, fine, you want to pick up Abraham Almonte, that's fine. You know, maybe you even want to designate Miguel Almonte, okay, you know, but maybe there is a pickup that warrants that, but like, I don't think Abraham Almonte is that guy. So it's just really bizarre, especially when, you know, Almonte looked like he had a shot. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but someone we know said that he might be closing for the Royals this year in a prediction. And, you know,
that's very possible.
While I think
someone made that prediction,
I think that was astute, and whoever came up with that idea is a fine human being. Well, they're very wrong now. So not to name names, but his initials are me.
literally.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. It's really weird. And then they further went and they traded him to the Angels for cash, which is like, for whatever reason, you know, that tells me that there must not be some significant, serious reason why they dumped Almonte. It's just that they decided he was the guy that was cuttable. And it's like, I don't get it. Because I figure if he had, I mean, he does have some shoulder soreness, and he was going to start the year on the DL in Omaha, which... we didn't really hear about that until he was optioned down there, or when they designated him, I think. So fine, but it doesn't seem to be too serious. And I think if someone is going to acquire him and put him on their 40-man roster like the Angels have, that kind of injury is not something that you would probably seek out to take up that 40-man spot, unless it's so serious that it's going to be something that they can – you know, put him on the 60-day DL, but it sure doesn't seem like that's, you know, the situation. So, you know, if there's any kind of like clubhouse beef, I haven't heard anything about that, you know, throughout any of this, you know, through his whole career in the organization. So, I mean, that sure doesn't seem like it to me. Doesn't seem to be an off the field thing because, you know, the Angels went right after him. I presume that they probably claimed him and then they worked out the trade. So I don't know. I don't know what, you know, kind of led to this other than the Royals just deciding that it was time to let him go. And, you know, maybe Almonte, maybe Miguel Almonte, I should specify, never turns into anything. And he certainly 2 years ago kind of looked like that was what he was doing. But, you know, he's 24 years old. He's got plenty of time to kind of figure something out. And the way he looked this spring, I think, it, you know, it's got a non-zero chance of being a mistake and maybe a significant one down the line. You know, all for Abraham Almonte, who, nothing against him, but it's like, you know, he's not even someone that they claim to put on the big league roster. They sent him to Omaha. So, you know, that how badly did they want him if they're just going to dump him down there in case they need another outfielder at some point? It's a really weird transaction at every step of it, like just all of it. It's very weird. So I don't know. I'm kind of confused by it, and maybe something else will come up, but I don't know. Just don't know.
Yeah. It's incredibly weird. And, you know, and again, I think to borrow from Dave Lesky, I saw him tweet out on Twitter that if you want to make the argument that the Royals have seen enough from Almonte, they know he's not going anywhere, and that he wasn't going to be anything at the major league level, okay, you can listen to that argument, and it might not even disagree with it, especially if the, you know, the argument is that the Royals know something we don't because they see him every day, which is absolutely
possible,
fair.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, there is a prevailing thought that at the very least he could have done something good for this organization, just as you mentioned, and the Royals chose to forego that for someone like Abraham Almonte, who, you know, at this point, he's one of those guys. He is what he is. I don't know that there's any hope that he's going to blow up somehow and become this amazing player. It's just, that's just not what's happening here. And so it's just, it's such a head scratcher. I mean, I guess you could say he's played all three outfield positions in the past. I mean, if they're really concerned about that, I guess that's like the best thing you can say about this guy. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, you can, does over the course of a season, so, you know, 162 games, does Abraham Almonte net you more wins than what Miguel Almonte does? I guess that's the question, you know? I mean,
there's probably an argument that they both get you zero wins because
that's right. Yeah.
I mean, will they, you know, but I feel like Almonte would have been on the big league team at some point this year. Miguel Almonte, God, kind of, and maybe Abraham Almonte will too, especially if Orlando continues to struggle. But like, you know, you've got Bubba Starling, who is feasibly going to be healthy again later, maybe, possibly, who maybe if he plays well, they give him a look. Billy Burns
if
is
you
in
believe,
Omaha.
If you believe Abraham Almonte is worth picking up over Miguel Almonte, then you believe that when I say you, I mean the Royals, that Bubba Starling will be healthy enough to play at the major league level. Healthy and good enough to play at the major league level this year.
I don't get it. I don't get it. And you know, maybe it is. Maybe it's something early season again. Maybe it's just that this is all that's happening, and it's so strange that, you know, we're all obsessing about it because it's out of nowhere. But I don't know. I just it seems like you're taking a guy who is only, you know, who's still pretty young, who still has prospect status. And potentially has some upside for you as a pitcher, and you dumped him off for a fourth, fifth outfielder. And I just I don't really see the point of the move. It very likely doesn't matter either way, but I feel like in 3 years Almonte would probably be more likely to have some value for the Royals than Abraham Almonte. God, Miguel Almonte would have more value than it. People know what I mean.
Yes.
I think.
The case of the two Almontes.
God. Yeah.
So anyway, you know, I got your guess is as good as mine on this one. You know, whether it's you, Mike, or you, any of the listeners out there, it's your guess is as good as mine in terms of what the Royals are going for, what they're trying to do, and how exactly they're trying to do it. and that's not even it. You know, they've made other moves this week. Of course, Nate Karns went to the DL.
Yep.
We've got that on. So, you know, any hopes. And then they said when he comes back, he's going to be bullpen, or he's going to be in the bullpen. And, you know, that was the plan all along.
Sure,
it was. He's always going to be a bullpen guy.
We've always been at war with East Asia.
Right, yeah, you know, even though last season he was a starter, but, you know, whatever. So, classic Ned, classic Royals on that. But, you know, he'll come back and he'll be in the bullpen, you know, if and when he comes back. I mean, he'll come back this season, but, you know, he'll be in the bullpen as opposed to starting. So, you know, that's another one that, you know, it's not like it's a move by the Royals. They can't help if he gets hurt, but the nugget about him, you know, always a bullpen guy.
Mm-hmm. When they used him as a starter all spring.
Yeah. It's classic Royals.
Very cagey misdirection there. Ned Yost. Mm-hmm. We threw him 5 innings this spring, but he's only throwing 1 in this season.
Gotcha again. Yeah. The rest of Major League Baseball. So, but yeah, in the
he'll probably be really good in the bullpen, to be fair.
No, he probably will be.
You know, one of the things when the Royals got him, when they traded Gerard Dyson for him, that kind of stuck out was that third time through the order thing that Hamill has a problem with. Carnes had a big problem with it. Like, everything, strikeouts went down, walks went up, hits went up. So, you know, maybe if he is like a 2-inning reliever in the mold of like a Mike Minor or Andrew Miller, I'm not, you know, saying he's going to be Andrew Miller, but like, he can do that. He can go through where maybe you see, you know, 6, 7, 8 hitters and just kind of get through that lineup one time to bridge it to guys in the back of the bullpen. Maybe he can be really, really effective in that kind of a role. I think he would eventually give you more value as a starter just because that would cover more innings, and I think he's got the stuff to do it. But, you know, if this is what it takes to kind of have him be productive and protect him from further injury, since he did come off of a pretty significant surgery last season, I guess that makes sense. The explanation doesn't make sense because they sure didn't treat him like they were going to use him out of the bullpen ever all spring. But, you know, I guess it makes some sense. It does weaken the starting rotation because Eric Skoglund's going to be in that spot for now. So, but I don't know.
And it's, again, not to say he'll be similar to what you were saying, not to say he'll be someone like Wade Davis, but his career so far, him being Nate Carnes, does feel somewhat similar to how, you know, Wade Davis, Rose acquired him in a trade. He was a starter that people had kind of hoped for and hadn't been able to put it all together. And now he's moving to the bullpen, and you think, you know, yeah, he really could have some staying power in there. You know, I think because he was always a guy, and back to when the Rose acquired him, like you said, I remember part of the discussion was there's hope for him as a starter, and there could be some, he could develop into something good there, but a lot of people really liked him as a bullpen piece in the future, you know. And actually, it was actually a similar line for Wade Davis when the Royals acquired him. So it'll be interesting to see. And I agree with you. I do think he can actually do really well in the bullpen for the Royals. So hopefully that's the case when he comes back.
Be a bad setup guy.
No, but you know, and as you mentioned, Eric Skoglund now in the starting rotation for the Royals. So
if they keep having the weather problems, though, he might never get a game in.
He just may never. Yeah. But that's interesting nonetheless to have Skoglund out there.
He had a good spring. You know, so, I mean, he pitched well enough to get a look. I just, you know, I'm not sure he's going to be the guy. But if
tempered expectations.
Yeah. It's fifth starter spot. So, I mean, you kind of get what you get, and just live with it, I suppose. When you're a 70, 75 win team, you just, you know, get through that day. So, and maybe he has the upside to kind of do something, or maybe someone like Clay Buchholz, who's on a minor league deal, or Kyle Loesch, who they signed to a minor league deal, which took him long enough to get him in the organization.
Yeah.
He's another one of those. Someday I'm going to have to write down, like, guys who you're surprised haven't been Royals yet. Because Kyle Loesch is, like, the number 3 starter on that team. Because it seems like they got linked to him, like, every year for, like, 4 years in the last decade. Like, oh, they're looking at him. Okay, cool. Well, they got him for, like, nothing. He hasn't been in the league for 2 years, but they got him. It's like Jair Jurgens. They finally got him on a minor league deal in, what, 15 or something?
Yeah.
When... God, there was a rumor that the Braves were asking for Will Myers for him. It was like, okay.
All right.
Sure. Like, I'm going to ask my boss for a $200,000 raise. I can ask for it.
Yes.
I'm not going to get it.
I feel like I feel like Rafael Furcal was on that list.
Yeah.
As well.
A lot of early
2000 Braves that were out there.
Fair.
on that list, which makes sense.
Yeah.
But that would actually be a fun list to compile. Maybe we'll do that when we get into the dog days of summer.
Yeah, that's a good June project.
That's a very good June project, a mid-season, an all-star break. Let's target that. Let's target that for the all-star break project there, because that week we'll have very little to talk about.
Yeah, we'll have Sal Perez and maybe one other person to celebrate that week. Unless people vote like crazy, which...
Yeah, so because of the next few years that Sal Perez is under contract and his reputation and likely poor roster from the Royals, he's going to go down with like 10 All-Star games.
Yeah, he's going to cash
credit.
In on
I mean,
that.
He's going to look from just on paper, when it comes to accolades, he's going to be up there. Like, he's going to be one of those guys that, you know, and here obviously everyone's biased, but when you're talking from a national perspective, it's going to come to Hall of Fame discussion, you know, and you're going to be like, well, he was really good catcher,
12-time
a tough position. 12-time All-Star. He won 6 Gold Gloves or however many it ends up being. World Series champion, World Series MVP. You know, he hit, I don't know, 200 home runs, however many he hits in his career. It's like, or 250, call it. And it's like, well, I mean, you know, there's... I don't think Sal Perez is or should be in the Hall of Fame, but that argument is going to be made by people.
Yeah.
When that time comes. And a lot of it is going to be based on that. And a lot of it's going to be helped by the fact that, you know, Salvador Perez is going to be on a lot of rosters like today's Royals roster to help him out for the All-Star appearances anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's very true.
So that'll be interesting. Oh, man. What else has happened this week?
Kyle Zimmer got designated for
assignment. Oh, that's right.
Which,
that's also – that happened before the Almonte.
That
business.
Was opening day, which not that surprising. And I think he – I think tomorrow or today when you're listening to this, Thursday, the 5th at least, is the last day for him to get claimed off release waivers. And if that happens, the Royals can retain him in the organization. He just wouldn't be on the 40-man roster, which I think is most likely because the team, you know, if you're going to claim Kyle Zimmer, it's the same kind of thing. It's like you got to find a 40-man spot to keep him. And it's like, why would you, like, what do you, why are you going to do that? Why are you going to waste the time to even bother? Who just continuously hurt. It's the same thing. But, you know, if he does clear, at least they can keep him in the organization and see what happens. And he's not taking up that 40-man spot. So I, you know, it was a little surprising, but in the end, not that surprising that they went that route. It's certainly not like the out of nowhere Almonte thing. So there was that. Willy Peralta was designated for assignment. He cleared waivers. He's in Omaha. What else did they do? That's kind of about it, I think, as far as, like, transactions. I mean, obviously, they brought up Cam Gallagher when Sal Perez went on the DL. Mm-hmm. I think that's it for transactions, like, significant transactions that really impact the big league roster. Obviously, they added Blaine Boyer, again, for some reason.
Because how can you not? I mean, when Blaine Boyer is out there,
yeah,
you can't not get him.
Yeah,
I don't know what baseball league you're a fan of, but the one I'm a fan of demands action.
Yeah,
in these scenarios,
when Blaine Boyer came into the game on opening day, I went to the Hall of Fame and walked around there.
Yeah,
that's just
that was a smart choice.
I have no interest in Blaine Boyer on this team, and I feel bad for saying that because Blaine Boyer is just trying to do a job and stay in the league. But like, I don't,
and has done a good job at staying in the league.
Yeah, I don't. I just don't feel like he's got much left to offer. So I don't know, but he was added. Ryan Gomes was added. Yeah, that's about it. I think that covers all those moves. I don't see anything else. The only other thing that kind of happened was that the Royals have been using the shift a lot more.
Oh, that's right.
In
yes.
fact, they, I think a big part of their win yesterday was being able to get out of a jam because a line drive up the middle turned into a double play because the Royals had shifted to the left and Whit Merrifield was directly behind second, was there to make the play, whereas otherwise it's usually a single ride up the middle. And I believe there was a runner on third, I think, at that point. So, you know, that ended up helping the Royals out quite a lot. And the stated goal is that Ned Yost wants to use the shift a lot more, whereas in the past, the Royals really didn't use that shift that much. In 2015, especially, they, you know, in the extreme examples, the, you know, the lefty power hitter type, the Brandon Moss, the Lucas Duda type, that usually was the only guy that got shifted. Yeah, they did it then. But for the most part, they went pretty straight up. And this year, they're going to move it around a little bit more. So I think that's kind of interesting. That's kind of that's, you know, built off of some of the analytics and the analytics team that kind of moved that up to Ned, and Ned bought into it, and so they're going to give it a shot. And so far, you know, they're at least vocally they seem to be kind of pleased with the results, and that, you know, the it's been a positive thing. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
And, you know, it's for all the flack we've given Ned Yost in the past, you know, not as much in recent years, but very much so at the beginning of his tenure, which, you know, almost coincided with the beginning of this show, was a little bit before we started recording this show. But, yeah. You know, there was a lot of criticism to be made, and quite frankly, it was warranted at the time. But I got to give Ned Yost credit where it's due. You know, you could argue that it's too late at this point, not too late, but later than it should have been. But at the same time, you know, well, he did switch, and it's tough for, you know, we've talked about in the past why it shouldn't be tough, but it is for a lot of, you know, quote unquote baseball people, the old school types, if you will, to really kind of shift that way of thinking and that methodology. But here we are where, like you said, you know, Ned was presented with some information and what, you know, a recommendation perhaps on what they should do with that information, and he took it and he's changed, and, you know, good for him. I think that's awesome that he has, you know, developed. And we, you know, as you were kind of talking about and some of the differences we've had with the team from a few years ago, that this, you feel like the switch is a little bit more necessary because of the athleticism and different things like that. So, you know, maybe that has felt like it's forced his hand, but if he starts seeing results, then, you know, it's going to be easier to do it in the future. It almost similar to how the Royals used the bullpen in 14-15 playoff runs and those seasons. You know, I don't think Ned Yost ever anticipated that he would use a bullpen like he did in those seasons.
Yeah.
But he had it and it worked and he rolled with it and he did it very effectively. So, you know, that was, you know, a positive for him that he was able to adapt to that situation. But, you know, beyond the Royals, I'm curious your thoughts on this. And there's, I think it was Clint Scholes in our Slack chat that kind of mentioned, you know, I don't know that he's necessarily thinks it should be banned himself, talking about the shift, but just, you know, if Major League Baseball is in the business of wanting to, you know, create more offense and kind of change how the game is played, banning the shift would be a really good way of doing that. I'm kind of curious how do you feel about that? Banning, if you were to do something like banning the shift,
I mean,
you think that's a way MLB could go, and would you agree with it if they did?
I don't know how you would enforce it. You know, I would think there'd be a lot of unintended consequences from that, you know, because like, what if you are somehow shifted and you happen to be a step or two out of a range and like you make a play and double somebody up, and that ends a rally, you know, like there's so much of a gray area of where that kind of is. it's not like they're going to mark out territories on the field. I can't imagine.
Like free throw lanes?
Yeah, you know, like... I mean, it just doesn't seem like that's some. That's such a radical thing for baseball to even, like, I don't know how you would enforce that. You look at how the strike zone is applied right now, where there's, in the rule book, there is a, you know, there's a literal explanation of what the strike zone is supposed to be, but, like, you know, you see it all the time. Some umpires are a little bit more liberal on the sides of it. Some are a little more low. Some are higher. Some, you know, it might change depending on how that pitcher is throwing and how his command is. And guys like Maddux and Glavin, man, they got Hall of Fame careers by figuring out how to kind of little by little inch that out, you know, to where if you're consistently mm-hmm. on this corner and you can maybe get another inch off the black and, you know, eventually you get the reputation that earns you some extra strikes. So then, like, I don't know how you would ban it per se, other than saying, like, you can only have two infielders on either side of second base. I mean, I guess you could maybe do it that way.
I was thinking that's pretty much the only way you could do it. You'd have to be pretty liberal with, you know, basically making that second base a dividing line.
Yeah. And, you know, but the other thing is, like, fundamentally, if you have a shift on, there is an open spot somewhere, you know? And so, like, you look at what the Astros have done is every now and then, they did this against Joey Gallo on opening day, at least. I don't know if they've done it much since, but they took Bregman at third base and they moved him into being a fourth outfielder because Gallo is such an extreme pull hitter. And so they basically played first baseman where he'd be, and you know, second and short were on the right side of second base, and there was nobody between second and third base defensively on the infield. And it's like, you know, you can use that. You know, guys can figure that out. Alex Gordon did it as part of his revival. Mike Moustakas, that was a big key to him kind of getting over his really bad 2014 and having his first career year of 2015 is being able to go the other way. And it's like, you can adapt to that. You know, it's not like if you're pulling into the shift all the time that you have to continue to do that. You know, and I get it. Maybe it takes someone out of their game, but, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, when I think back even way back to, like, how baseball kind of evolved, like, you know, there's a game, Town Ball, from way back in the 19th century, you know, pre-Civil War, very regional game. And really, you could have 9, 10, 12 players on the field. And what ended up kind of happening is players will go where the ball generally seems to be hit more often. You know, it's not like the rules prescribed your third baseman plays here, your shortstop plays here, your second baseman plays there. It ended up being that teams realized that, okay, guys usually hit the ball around this area, so we're going to put a guy there to field it, and that became a shortstop. And it's just, that's kind of how it develops. And so if now you can measure some of these things and figure out that, hey, this guy here hits it to the right side, you know, 75% of the time, why would you not do that? If he doesn't want to hit into the shift, he can adjust to it. And so I think it's really tough to enforce it. I don't know that it's necessary. I just think there's a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily going to be gained by banning it, quote unquote, or whatever. You know, I think it's really tough to take that step without having something else weird come up.
I guess your only argument for a ban would be that, you know, the end result of this would become that eventually data that we have on who hits what where, spray charts, all those types of things are so advanced and so good at determining the most likely scenario that it's worth the risk to completely shift your defense every single play. And, you know, even specifically, you might even be able to do it you know, by pitch. I mean, that might be too much, but like eventually
you'll see that sometimes though, where like you get two strikes on a guy or even one strike on one of those extreme lefties or something, you'll see the third baseman, you know, cut down and he'll be like the deep guy on that extreme shift in right field because one strike or two strikes, that guy's not going to try to bunt. You know, so that play is taken away. So, yeah, you can do that. I've seen it where the Phillies talked about changing outfielders, switching around their outfield based on the player at bat.
Yeah, and I mean, it's
totally fair and reasonable if that's what you want to do. Yeah. It's just unconventional.
So, yeah, I mean, instead of having kind of your designated positions, it would essentially be, you know, seven players who just kind of huddle up basically in the middle before every new batter and say, okay, here's where you're going to go and here's where you need to go and all that. And I guess that's the fear. And you say, okay, is that what you want baseball to become? And, you know, I'm always a fan of teams that find inventive ways to try and kind of legally, I don't know if I say game the system, but you know, it's like, hey, they're doing what they've figured out is something that can be successful. And it's trying, you know, it's a calculated risk because as you said, those extreme shifts, there's an entire part of the field that's open. They're just daring you to take advantage of it as the hitter. And if you can't, that's not on them. It's not their fault that they're in the right position, you know? So, you know, I don't know that I can see a ton of similar to you. I don't know how you can enforce it. I don't know how there's a ton of arguments, you know, for it other than it's too successful. You know, it's it's too good of a method and it makes baseball less exciting to watch because outs happen more frequently, less runs are scored, et cetera, et cetera. And there is the kind of end result argument that you could argue part of the obsession with power and hitting home runs that's developed has kind of increased with the prevalence of the shift because with so many, you know, more outs happening because of the shift, it becomes much more dependent as a game on hitting home runs.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
if you can't hit it in that hole by second because that guy's in shallow right, well, you try to hit over the fence.
Yeah. Why the hell not? You know, they can't put anybody there to field that ball. So,
right.
So, I mean, it's going to be an interesting thing. I mean, if the Royals are starting to embrace the shift, then has proliferated in baseball.
It has peaked.
Very much so. Yes. So the idea of, you know, we've reached peak shift in baseball, I think, given that the Royals are part of this. So if you're going to do something, now's the time. I don't necessarily think anything needs to be done, but you know, it needs to happen soon because it's getting to be such a huge part of the game that if you let it go much further, it's going to cause a bigger issue to try and change it than just to leave it be. So it'll be interesting to see how this kind of develops and moves forward as something that baseball uses so frequently now.
Yeah. I get the side of like bringing up the question because it's like strikeouts are going up and guys throw harder, guys throw with more spin. There's more ways to measure that stuff. You know, and so the pitchers are in a lot of ways ahead of the batters on some of that stuff. And so it does kind of become this league where the ball's not put in play as often as it was. And a lot of the excitement is, you know, seeing those guys field the ball. And so if they're, you know, if they're hitting the ball right at someone all the time, then yeah, I get that. And I get that that's where it kind of comes from, that you worry that the game becomes so mechanical because it's home run, strikeout, hit into shift. And then, you know, everything else is the exception. I think that's a worry that is, you know, fair. I think it's really tough to get around that. And, you know, I just think that banning the shift I don't know that it really fixes it. I think it's something that's going to be done and someone sometime will figure out how to beat a shift and then everything will adjust back. Or maybe it'll just randomly stop happening. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you'll see it in other things where, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, do teams really do the run and shoot offense in football anymore? I mean, the West Coast offense is kind of a thing, but I mean, it's developed into another element of like the short passes, and
it's kind of evolved a lot of the principles that were in the run and shoot. But what was known as the run and shoot is no longer really run, but some of the same principles. And that could be something where, you know, similarly it happens. And that was kind of my thought as well too, that, okay, if it goes to the extreme where everyone's completely repositioning, you know, all nine players on one side of the field, whatever you want to say, or all eight players, you know, if that's really what ends up happening, then it will balance out because teams will have no choice but to somehow try and get the ball to the other side of the field. And, you know, one of the kind of precursors to baseball of cricket, you know, that's how cricket is run. The players are just out there. Now, the difference is there's much more control in the way cricket is played, to where, you know, the batter has a lot more say in where the ball goes. So it's easier to, or it's, you know, there's not as much kind of to look at and say, okay, well, here's where he normally hits the ball, because at any point he could just decide he wants to hit it behind him.
Right, you know? And that's not a foul ball. So it's like that ball's exactly in play. So, yeah.
Exactly. And they have to be kind of everywhere. But it's not quite the same in baseball, where it's you know, much harder for the hitter to have, even the best hitters of all time, you know, it's a struggle for them to pinpoint exactly where they're hitting the ball. So that's kind of in the favor of shifts being successful. But I mean, it's a fascinating topic. I'm really curious to see how this develops. It's going to be down the road. You know, it's obviously not good where anything that happens this year. The shift will still be a part of the game, but you know, maybe this offseason they'll start talking about it. Maybe in a year or two, something will happen. And it'll kind of, I mean, it's already changing the complexion of baseball. Yeah. So I don't know how they're planning on, if they want to do anything about it or however that works. So that'll be, I'm definitely curious to see how it'll end up.
Yeah. And I don't know what, like, it's not like they would just, I don't know. I don't know if they would radically go to banning it entirely, or it would be some kind of small measure to, I don't know.
Maybe you get like three shifts a game or something. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how they would start to like implement that rule or design that rule or what have you, but I don't know. I mean, they might explore that just because it is such a, you know, three true outcomes type of game more and more each year. But, you know, you might also see teams that start to develop guys who have more opposite field power and maybe more opposite field ability, or hit to all fields, or maybe more contact guys. And it just is, you know, different ways of figuring out how to set up your stance. I think things will evolve one way or another. But I don't know. I mean, if they come up with a rule that kind of does it, that opens the field up a little bit more, I'm not going to complain about that. I think that'd be interesting. But I just don't know how you can implement and enforce a quote ban without it creating other gory problems that then require other rule changes and so on and so forth. But I don't know. Yeah, it'd be interesting to kind of see what happens after this year. And you know, I'm sure there's going to be proposals somewhere, you know, even if they're short lived, someone's going to bring up something.
Absolutely. So, all right. Well, with that, I think we will leave you, whenever you're listening to this show, to continue about your business. Sounds like we may have, we're going to have some bad weather.
No.
This weekend. So
no
it's
way.
Supposed to be really nice tomorrow. Tomorrow being Thursday.
You're
for
kidding me.
Recording this, but sounds like this weekend's not going to be great. So
that's great.
You know, hopefully, you know, weather has been messed up this past year and a half all around the country. So hopefully, you know, the Royals will won't have a ton more missed games that they'll have to make up later in the season, but we'll see. And hopefully they can use their last victory to kind of get back on track and wake up out of these offensive doldrums and give us a little bit more positive things to talk about. So we will be back next week to talk about that very thing, more Royals baseball, hopefully less wacky Royals roster moves to talk about and more wins. That's my vote for what I hope we get to talk about next week. So we'll see on that one. But thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to visit our sponsors, BP Kansas City, of course, tons of content that we keep pumping out every day. We're in full force now. Season is in full swing for us as well on there. So tons of great stuff from all of our very talented writers, BP Kansas City. Go head on over there and check out all of our analysis. If you can't get enough Royals from just this podcast alone, then that's the your best supplement right there. It's BP Kansas City. And then Kelly's Westport Inn, of course, longtime sponsor. Fantastic place. We wouldn't be here without them, so be sure and go visit them. And you know, I think they've finally recovered now after St. Patrick's Day, a few weeks ago. So if you're going to brave the cold and get out this weekend, but you want to stay inside, Kelly's has a heated roof. So remember that. So you can go and you can get some fresh air while still avoiding the frigid temperatures. Or you can just stay inside and hang out and have some beers, which is always a very pleasant option. So be sure and visit our sponsors. And thank you all so much for listening. We love you all. Couldn't do it without you. We really appreciate the listeners. Love the feedback we keep getting, more and more Twitter, email, et cetera, et cetera. So keep it coming. We love to hear from all of you. Any questions you guys have or comments on the show, or you want to just call us big dummy heads, then please do.
Wouldn't be the first time.
No, it would not. And it absolutely would not.
And clearly I deserve it because I thought Miguel Almonte was going to be closing games in August. But, you know,
whatever. Yeah. Well, you might be right about that.
Just not for Kansas City. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see. But thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back next week. So until then, thank you. Thanks for stopping by. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.
Hey, Troy, what are you doing this weekend?
Going to grab a beer somewhere. What do you have in mind?
I heard about this awesome new bar downtown. It's called Rage. The waitresses have a contest to see who has the most piercing.
Oh, man, that's not really my scene.
Well, there's another bar close by called Spit Cup. Check it out. The bartenders wear chaps, and every hour they shoot a guy.
No, seriously, I just want a bar where I can sit down and watch the game.
Okay, I've got just the place. It's called Lilac. You sit on pillows drink from eucalyptus leaves.
No, Ned, but I just want a place where I can get a cheap drink and watch the football game.
Okay, I got it. This place, it's got a TV. It's called 816. Limitatosis.
Yep.
All their drinks come in NBA hats.
Man, I just want a place like Kelly's.
Oh, you mean Kelly's Westport Inn? No, they've got all the basketball and bowl game. They've even got a heated roof. The view is really nice, too, if you know what I'm saying. Why didn't you just say you wanted to go to Kelly's?
Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road. Make it your place to go any time of the week.